Welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. My guest today, Katherine Heine, has traveled one of the most interesting and bonkers roads into publishing that I have heard in a while. She was published in The New Yorker at the incredible age of 25. Praised as a prodigy, her work appeared in an anthology alongside Alice Munro, Raymond Carver, and Ann Beattie. And then she sort of disappeared, and she popped back up at 47 when she published her first story collection, Single Carefree Mellow, followed by two novels, Early Morning Riser and Standard Deviation. And now she's back with another short story collection. In those intervening years, she married a former spy. She wrote a boatload of YA books under a pen name and emerged the hilarious and gut-punching writer she is today. Games and Rituals came out last year. It's now out in paperback. We'll talk about what that pause gave to her writing, the situation versus the story, finding the aboutness of your story, what short story form allows her to do that novels do not, how to weave backstory into your short stories, approaching revision in novels versus stories, her thoughts on publishing and how the industry has changed along the way, and so much more. Katherine Heine, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back. Let's go way back. And I'd love to just unpack what happened on that publishing road. So did you grow up always knowing you were going to be a writer, or tell me about those early years and finding your way into writing initially?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer, but I grew up in Midland, Michigan, which is the headquarters of the Dow Chemical Company. And it's a really corporate town. And, you know, everybody there has very intensive, like, jobs, not creative jobs, but more company jobs. So I grew up thinking that was what you did. But in college, I took all these creative writing courses. And then my dad said that he would pay for me to go to law school, which is something I said I wanted to do, or to one of the top two creative writing schools. And I didn't get into any law schools. I'm sure they were all like, why does this girl who takes exclusively creative writing classes want to go to law school? And then I applied to Iowa, the Iowa Writers Workshop, and to Columbia. And Iowa rejected me. And then I got stuck in their rejection system, and they rejected me by letter every 3 days until I called them and was like, relax, I'm not coming. But I got into Columbia, and I went there, and it was life-changing.
And then from there, you had that first story published by The New Yorker. I assume there were intervening stories.
Well, I was in graduate school, and I was writing stories. And there was one story that I had sent out to a lot of literary magazines, to 31 literary magazines, and nobody had accepted it. And then my friend Jennifer was like, well, what about The New Yorker? And I said, I didn't send it there. And she's like, you're supposed to send everything there first. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't know that. So I sent the story in on a Thursday, and Roger Angel called me on Friday, which I didn't even know the mail worked that fast, let alone Roger reading the slush pile. But he called and said, can I speak to Katherine Heine? And I thought it was the landlord, because we were always behind on the rent. So I was like, nope, Katherine's not here. Sorry, gone for the weekend. We can't get in touch with her. And he was like, well, this is Roger Angel from The New Yorker. And I was like, wait, it's me. And I think that's just sort of confirmed my reputation as a ninny for a long time. But then they took the story and they published it. And I mean, I'm still amazed by it all these years later.
And so at that point, you started, I'm trying to remember how the young adult fiction came about. So you left the track of literary publishing and then took that job.
Well, right around, like, The New Yorker was my first published story. And then I had a story in 17. And then I had a story in Sassy magazine, because my stories at that time tended to feature very young protagonists. And editors saw the story in 17, I think, and asked me if I'd be willing to write books for young adults. And at that point, I was working as a waitress. And I was like, if this lets me stay home in my pajamas and I make more money, then I'll do it. And I wrote a lot of YA books. It taught me a lot about how to be a disciplined writer.
So there was a great article that you did for LitHub a while ago, and I'm actually going to link to that in our show notes because how many things you did learn. I mean, the importance of deadlines or working on a deadline, how much you can get done. I mean, it's just amazing how quickly they were demanding stories and the quick turnaround of deadlines and teaching you plot. I thought all of those lessons were really fantastic for writers. So I'd love to share that with our listeners. But I was curious as you were doing that. So you wrote like 25, is that right? Like 25
Yeah, I
YA
think
books.
24, 25. Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if you felt like through all of the writing training, through the time at Columbia and the MFA and the time training on those books, what do you feel like made the biggest difference in your writing career, helpful wise? Did you feel like it was the education, or did you feel like it was doing that many YA books, or kind of what makes the biggest difference for you?
I think it's a combination. I think that at Columbia, you learn how to workshop a story and how to edit it. And I mean, it takes a long time before you're able to apply those skills to your own work, but that is something you learn to do. And you know, you're just surrounded by writers all the time, and everybody's writing, and you constantly have stories up in workshop. And if not, then you're workshopping somebody else's. It's a very immersive experience, but that sort of teaches you, I think, more how to write well. And writing all those young adult novels taught me how to write to a deadline. And I mean, I look back on that, and I was too young or too inexperienced to say, like, I need more time to write this book. Instead, I just wrote. And it really, I mean, I guess the basic thing I learned is that writer's block disappears when you have a deadline.
Yeah, isn't that true? Once you have the fire under you. It's funny, I was just listening to a Stephen Colbert show. Somebody was asking him how to become a late night host, and he's like, find a place that's putting on a play in 9 days and come up with the title of the play. And then you have to write that play and perform it in 9 days. And you'll be amazed because you'll do it. You'll actually write a play and stage it in 9 days. You know, he's like, whatever the deadline is. And then you have that on your resume and you're done. I was like, what a concept. But I guess this is something journalists know that, you know, literary writers have to figure out that deadlines are super useful.
Yeah, Stephen King gave an interview a long time ago saying that he writes every day of the year except his birthday and Christmas and the 4th of July. And he recently gave another interview saying that he felt like on the spot and had to say something. And that the truth is that when he's finishing a book, he works all days, including his birthday and Christmas and the 4th of July. And then there's a break while he waits for the next book to sort of take shape. And I think that's really true. I think as you're finishing a book, it becomes so all-consuming. So it's all you think about.
And you, I mean, you didn't even have that luxury back then because I read somewhere, maybe it was in that LitHub article where you were starting, you'd finish a book in the morning and you'd have to start the next one in the afternoon because the deadlines were so short. I was like, man.
And I wrote 10 pages a day. And if I took a day off, I wrote 15 pages a day for the next 2 days.
Oof.
It was intense.
So when you decided to leave that and then go back to writing novels, well, actually, so the first book that came out was a short story collection. Were you writing, well, I guess you wouldn't even have had time to be writing your own stories all the way along. So you just had to take a break, a hard stop, and then start in on literary short fiction again.
Well, when I was writing YA, I never had time. Well, I guess I had time, but I never had the creative energy to write my own stuff.
Yeah.
And then I was pregnant with my first child, and I just signed a book contract for another 4 books. And then my water broke at 26 weeks, and I went into the hospital, and I just canceled the book contract and gave the money back and said, I can't do this. So that was my break from YA. And then I was like a mother of 2 young children, and I found that all consuming too.
Yeah.
It wasn't until my younger son started first grade that then I sort of had the time and focus to start writing again. So in my first collection, there are a couple of stories that I wrote in my 20s, but the majority of them were written after my son started school. So
Got
in
it.
my 30s. I'm sure my sons are going to be like, "We didn't ask to be born. We didn't mean to interrupt your writing career." And I don't want them to feel that way, but raising small children is very labor intensive. I
It's
found it
no
very
joke. Yeah, it is no joke.
tiring.
And I imagine motherhood is, I mean, a kind of an essential component for writing. I mean, children give so many prompts, I would say, to our writing lives so much of the time. And I can see that perhaps in a few of these stories as well. So tell your children that, but for them, some of these stories might not have existed. You never know, right? So,
Yeah, I think all of them, it would safe to be safe to say.
yeah. Well, let's turn to this collection. So this is your second story collection, 11 stories. Tell me a little bit about, because, you know, not all stories does a collection make. I mean, they really have to cohere and they have to be sort of centering around certain themes and ideas. And so tell me a little bit about the collection as a whole and thinking about what the themes were that you were trying to explore in these 11.
I tend to write about teenagers a lot. I don't know whether that's because I'm immature and still emotionally a teenager. I do think that teenagers are very interesting because they make really, truly bonkers decisions. Like, I know this woman who chose to go to Reed College because her grandmother's name was Reed. Like, she felt that was a good enough reason to choose a college. So I think that I tend to write about teenagers and being the mother or the parents of teenagers. And I didn't start out to write a book, but there are a lot of teenagers in the book. And I wrote about half the stories in the collection between Standard Deviation and Early Morning Riser. I finished a novel and I sort of felt the urge to write a couple of short stories. And then I'll go more into this later, but I found it very hard to write during the pandemic. So I wrote the second half after the pandemic. And then there was one story, the title story, Games and Rituals. I actually wrote that in graduate school. It was the story I wrote before the story that was in the New Yorker. And we found a copy of it when we were moving. And my husband read it and he liked it. And he said it should be in the collection and it should be the title of the collection. And I always struggle with titles. So I was like, great, thank you for taking care of that. But when my editor first read the story Games and Rituals, she was like, it's kind of weird. It seems like it's in the 80s. And she said, it seems like it's in the 90s. And I was like, it's actually in the 80s. So I had to go back and, you know, in the original, they were like leaving each other messages on answering machines and watching VCR tapes and stuff. I had to really update it. But I think the idea of the story that protagonist is developing games and rituals to help her deal with her breakup, I hope that's a timeless theme.
Yeah, let's dive into that story a little bit because one
Sure.
of the things that I really love about story collections and this collection in particular is you can take some kind of interesting risks and do some experimental things that you can't necessarily do in novels. And this story was such a great example of that. There's another story in here that's written in the second person that allows, you know, that it's hard to sustain a novel in the second person. And so you get to do things in short stories that I think, you know, are just a little bit trickier to do in novels. But this story, it just vacillated back and forth. Maybe you can set it up a little bit, but it vacillates back and forth between a game and then a ritual and a game and a ritual. And I loved the structure of that. I mean, first of all, it was just so satisfying as a reader to have that. And then they're funny. We really have to add before we introduce all of the stories, your sense of humor is fantastic. And then there's just always this bite. I mean, the stories are really very serious and the topics that they tackle are really very serious, but it's done with such humor that it's much more tolerable and not as sad as it could potentially be without the amazing humor in here. But yeah, set us up in that story a little bit so we know who the characters are and kind of the trajectory of that story.
Well, it's a story about a girl who follows her boyfriend to New York. They move from Kansas to New York so he can go to law school, and she doesn't get into law school, but she follows him there and gets her own apartment, and they keep dating. And it becomes clear in the story that he wants to end the relationship in the kindest way possible. And she doesn't want to absorb that. So she has all these games that she sort of plays with herself, like if he says this, he's still in love with me. If he says this, he's not. And I mean, I had written this story when I just moved to New York from Kansas, and my relationship there had ended because my boyfriend was still in school. But I think I still had some leftover emotion, and I was trying to deal with living in New York City, which is such a huge shakeup for anyone. So I think the story is, in a little way, a love letter to New York City.
I love that you said that it's a love letter to New York City because there's one of these games she plays, which is how scary New York is to live in. And the stories she tells are, really very horrifying. I'm laughing, but they're really kind of, dangerous stories. However, that is such an aspect of New York. I just appreciate your phrase, a love letter to New York, because it felt like that. And then also felt like he kind of dragged her there for law school and then is leaving her there. Where she's just out there by herself and adding that level of tension, adding the situation or adding the story to the situation, I should say, adding the tension to the setup of the story, I thought was really great in that regard.
Well, when I was a very young writer, I needed to have a very strong structure in order to enable me to complete the story. If I just sat down and started writing, I lost control of it after a few pages.
Say more about that because I think there's such an inclination, especially for new writers, but even writers in early drafts of things. I mean, it's really easy for me to do a character sketch, but then I'm like, well, I could sit in a room with a character and have nothing happen, but have, some pretty delicious writing for, 20 pages and nothing happens. And so making something happen, I think, is tricky, right? And so, at what point in this, maybe we could use this story as an example of what point you kind of had to propel them into action as opposed to just be inside their relationship.
Well, I actually started my writing life as a poet. That's what I went to Columbia for. And I was like, I like poems because they're short and I can handle that. I can control it. But I transferred to the fiction program because that was really what I wanted to be writing. I think I've always struggled with plot. When I turned in my first novel, Standard Deviation, to my editor, when she gave me the notes, she was like, oh, I have some ideas about how to bring the plot forward. I was like, what plot might that be? I would love to hear this part of it. So I did write a lot of stories where not a lot happens. It just made me happy to write like a funny dialogue and interesting descriptions of people's relationships. And plot is something that I've learned as I go along. And it's hard. You understand why, people with thrillers, that's why they make the big bucks. That stuff is really hard.
Yes. Yeah. And the other thing that you do throughout these stories and games and rituals is another great example of how you can do it is weaving in. I mean, you have to know their backstory to know the heartbreak of what it's going to be for him to leave her here in New York. And so you have to get that backstory in. And with this structure where you're going, game, ritual, you can delve into their backstory and their. Forgetting where they came from. They came from like a small Midwest town or something to move to New York. And so you can get back in time. And I think time is another thing that's kind of difficult to manage in short stories because, your canvas is pretty limited. But time and again in these stories, you were really able to dip back in time really effectively without us knowing that we got too far away from the forward momentum of the story. So that was fun. Tell me a little bit about getting the backstory in there. Is that kind of always on your mind as to how to do that?
Well, I think you're forced to do it more economically in a story. I also think that I'm someone who thinks in stories, and sort of I define my past by a story or other people's pasts. So I think it comes very naturally to me to want to pick an incident from a person's past to describe them. Like once I worked for this man and I was working as a temp and I was doing his like budget, his trip expenses. And I was like, what is this one expense? There's nothing but a phone number. And he was like, I don't know, look it up. And so I called them and it was an escort agency. And he hadn't meant to use his work business card. But like, I'm like, that's one of my favorite stories. In relation to another story in the collection, Bridesmaid Revisited, I once wore a bridesmaid's dress to a temp job. And that had always been, that's just a story. That's part of my backstory. So I guess I think of characters as like me, and they have these stories who that illuminate their past. So it becomes very easy, I guess, for me to say, instead of saying this person was impatient, I would say this person was so impatient that, they got up out of their car during traffic jams to see what was happening in front of them.
Yeah, and I think, it's so easy to go from a sort of a story you would tell at a cocktail party of something that happened to you, like my boss had me call this phone number and it turned out to be an escort service, which is just too delicious to not use, right? I mean, that's amazing. To then realizing, okay, this has to mean something bigger. It has to stand for something bigger, or it has to be just part of a character's backstory, but that will inform something that happens to them. And that's I mean, that really is the hard thing for me is there's so many great situations, and then turning those situations to understand what they mean in the context of these characters' lives. I mean, Games and Rituals is really just this heartbreaking story about this girl being left after making a major move to a totally foreign city and just being slowly, slowly abandoned by her man. As I assume does that kind of happen organically in the process of trying to figure out who these people are? I mean, did you always know that she was going to be left by this man in the end, or did you write to sort of discover what was going to happen to them?
I think it's actually hard to remember, but I think that it was always, I think I knew he was gonna break up with her. But I think at the end of the book, at the end of the story, she's become sort of okay with that.
Yeah, right.
So
Right.
maybe this was me being okay with having, ended this relationship that I had in Kansas. But I also think that when I was younger and something funny happened, I tried to make that the whole story. Like, I would be like, oh, I have to write a story about this man who had me call his business expenses and it was an escort service. That would be like the first line of the story. And then I'd be like, oh, so now what happens? Just before the pandemic, I was at the dog park with our dog, and I talked to this man at the dog park who seemed sort of nice and normal and sane, and then he gave his dog a 10-minute warning when it was time to leave the dog park, and it made me really happy, and I wanted to go home. It made me want to go home and write, but it was the feeling that made me want to write. I didn't write about that incident. Whereas I think when I was younger, I would have been like, that was really funny. I have to write about it. Does that make sense?
Right. It totally makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of the suggestion of something much, much deeper that he would do that, which suggests like a whole iceberg underneath the surface of his personality that would cause him to do that. Right. I mean, he's got, and then the question is, A, what is it? And B, how else does that manifest in his life, in his other relationships with, real people? So, are you always carrying a notebook around to capture these moments, or do you just assume that like the good stuff's just going to be burned in your brain and you don't have to rely on notebooks to remember it?
I just assume that the good stuff will stick. I've never been a notebook person or a journal person because I used to keep journals when I was much younger, but I found that I only wrote in them when I was sad and depressed.
Hmm.
They were never happy journals. And somehow I was like, I don't think I need to revisit that. You know, when I'm with my friends, we're a lot of like, you know, remember that time a man in the park told you that your legs were not tan enough? Like we're always revisiting weird stories, but I have a good memory.
And tell me a little bit about, before we dive into a couple more of these stories, a lot of these, you were characterizing them as teenagers who make bonkers decisions, but you have some characters in here, as any character in any good literary piece should be, making bad decisions, because that's where all the fun lies. A lot of these characters are making, you deal with adultery and abortion and drug abuse in front of your kids. I mean, really, all the delicious stuff of life. Tell me if you ever worry about, like, I hear from a lot of readers, they just have no tolerance for adulterous characters, and they tolerate murder, no problem, but somehow adultery is just like off the table for them. And I'm always wondering if writers worry about not keeping their characters sympathetic, but at least relatable, right? Or at least where we can understand the choices they made. And to me, I found these characters so delightful and funny and wonderful. But I wondered if you ever had to worry about a character making such a bad choice that you were going to lose reader sympathy for them or something, or if that really doesn't matter.
I think it's not the choice the character makes as much as the decision making that goes into that choice. If the reader understands the decision making, then they'll go along with anything, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I like that. And maybe their reaction to it in the aftermath, like what they choose to do with that decision.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a great story in here about a woman who has an affair with a man years ago, ends up marrying him, and now they're kind of still saddled with his ex-wife and the ways they sort of quietly punish each other. And their whole backstory. That's another story where you really had to weave in a lot of backstory because we're in present day, but a lot of the igniting incidents happened kind of 20 years back. And as listeners are reading this book, perhaps for writerly insights, taking a look at the structure of these stories, I think, is so informative for how you can set up backstory. And I love the little tilde. What are those little curly Q's where you separate things in time and into sections? I love that in short stories because you can just like zip people around in time, and it's a wonderful, wonderful
Yeah, I think
device.
so too. I mean, in the story that you're talking about, 561, we moved recently, as I said, from Bethesda to Havre de Grace, and it's just was so hellish, so awful. I don't really understand why moving is so awful, but it really is. I mean, you're just taking like physical possessions and moving them from one house to another. I think maybe it's so hard because when you get to the new house for, like at least a week, and that's if you're super organized. For us, it was like a month. Every meal has to be like scrambled up from scratch. Every person's clothing, every bed where someone sleeps, like you're like, you have to figure that all out every day. But anyway, so we moved, and then I was thinking about the thing that people say that the top three worst experiences in life are death, divorce, and relocation. And so I thought, I want to write about somebody moving, but how can I get these other two elements in? And a long time ago, I worked at a suicide hotline. And the most amazing part of it to me were that there were regular callers at the suicide hotline, that we had this book of regulars and we got to know them. I guess I wouldn't have expected that as part of it, but there were people who called so much that you got to know their names and you knew their backstories. And I had a desire to, that was the way I thought I could get all three elements of death, divorce, and relocation in.
That raises a really interesting point about braiding strands into a story. And maybe that's kind of a good rule. I hadn't thought about that, but having sort of three strands that you're trying to braid through any narrative so that it kind of keeps tension going, either time or characters or situations. You then will naturally have sort of things in tension with each other and things trying to resolve against each other. That's very interesting because a lot of these stories did do that. I mean, there were two or three things going on in almost every one of these stories that, were related to each other, but also in tension with each other and trying to resolve against each other. And maybe unless you have a couple of balls in the air for a story, there's, you know, that's a good way to maybe go back to our plot discussion of making sure things are happening.
Well, I don't know that I give great advice about things happening, but I do think that if you're not braiding two things together, if there's not text and subtext, your writing will end up being very flat. And I think that I'm always braiding serious and humor together. Those are always two threads. And then there are some other threads that I pick up. But yeah, I think it's a continual braiding process. And the more of that that you can do, the more satisfying the story will be.
Yeah, to go back to your point about why relocation is so fraught, it's also, and this story really is, that's what it was exploring, is it's such a closing of a major chapter of life. Even if you're just moving out of your college dorm room, I mean, it's really a closing of a major chapter of your life, of whatever happened in that dorm room. And that's really what was going on in this story is, you know, this was this man, even though he'd been divorced from this woman for 20 years, this was really the final closing of the door on that chapter. That's where they had lived. They had all these memories. They're sitting there going through all their shit, right, that they had accumulated together. And it's devastating, right? I mean, it really is kind of a death of a particular time period, you know, kind of the death of a place as opposed to the death of a person. And you were able to get all of that in with just this hilarious, through the point of view of this hilarious woman who's walking back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, carrying all these boxes out for them. I mean, it was really very brilliant.
When I helped my dad move into assisted living, he had actually done a lot of the work himself, but I came for the final, you know, sort of clearing out. And so we had the take with us pile and the throwaway pile and the goodwill pile. And then my dad had this mythical new fourth category that he called too good for goodwill. And I was like, so what do we do with that, Dad? What's the end game with this too good? And, you know, I still don't know what he thought we were going to do with it, but this was obviously that was stuff that meant something to him and that he thought was valuable in some way. And, you know, eventually I sort of convinced him that people who go to Goodwill, such as me, and find something wonderful and it's a bargain, that totally makes their day. But yeah, I think that was somewhat on my mind when I was writing that story too.
We'll be back with more from Catherine Heine talking about games and rituals in just a moment. You're listening to Writers on Writing. There are three quick ways you can support the show if you are so inclined. The first is to leave us a review. However you are listening to the podcast, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, just leave a quick review up there, quick, easy, and free. If you're liking the show, you can also visit our Patreon page. We share some tips and tricks. That's a great way for us to stay in touch with you and you to stay in touch with us. We're at patreon.com/writersonwriting. And the last is to visit our bookshop on bookshop.org. As you're buying books, if you're picking up some of these books of the authors we have on the show or looking for our recommendations, it's a great way to support independent bookstores and to help the show out. We're at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. Let's get back to it with Catherine Heine talking about games and rituals. Getting in and getting out of anything, novel or short story, is hard. But getting into a short story and getting out, frankly, is, I think the stakes are higher because the canvas is so limited. You know, it has to be so tightly constructed. And you really have to just, you know, you can't spend a lot of time setting something up. You just got to be dropped kind of right into the middle of the situation. So is that a lot of, do stories start where they start and kind of stick? Do you stick the beginning pretty early, or do you find yourself having to cut? Like, I always find myself having to cut the first like two or three pages of a story as I'm clearing my throat, trying to figure out what the hell I'm talking about.
The warm up.
The warm up. Yeah.
I don't write chronologically. I just write whatever part of the story I have the clearest idea for, or that I feel the most inspired to write that day. So usually I write the beginning when I'm maybe halfway through the story, and then I can decide what's important, what has to be put up there in the front. And usually about three quarters of the way through, I see the ending. I understand what it's going to be. I don't know the exact images or dialogue or language that I'm going to use, but I can see what I'm going to see what's happening. But sometimes I write the end then at about the three quarter mark, and then I go back and fill in. I know this sounds really crazy. Most people write chronologically, but I've never done that.
Do you start with sort of the different strands and braids, or those are discovered through the writing process too?
Those are discovered through the writing.
Okay.
Definitely.
And then how many revisions would you say stories usually go through? Like, how long would you work on it? I'm sure it varies, but generally, how long are you with a story before you let it go?
I would say 2 months. But I mean, some days when I'm working, all I do is rework a page that I've already written. So I do a lot of the revision before the story, before I ever show the story to anyone.
Yeah, and I always love dealing with elderly characters because they're just like natural. I mean, I hate to say this, but they really are just naturally humorous. I mean, the situations that happen with older people are just naturally going to be very funny. And I always wonder if part of that is because it's devastating, right? I mean, aging, I mean, if we're all lucky enough, we're all going to be going through it. And it's so you can see where things are headed, and it's, you know, never going to be in a great, never going to be in a good direction. So it's sort of natural built-in gallows humor into, you know, writing about older people, which you had the opportunity to do several times in here. I know we've talked about writing a lot about teenagers, but you kind of have both ends of the age spectrum where people are making, you know, questionable choices at both ends of the age spectrum. So yeah, I wonder if there's a wonderful story in here about a woman with her elderly dad. And so you had, I have heard interviews where you're talking about, you kind of had the setup of that story laid out for you, but then it had to become, you had to make it something bigger and more devastating. And I wonder if we could unpack that one just a little bit.
The story started because my dad had severe hearing loss, and I took him to get this special hearing aid that we had to go to like four appointments, and it really improved his hearing. And then 6 months later, he mistook it for a cashew and he ate it. And I was so frustrated, but at the same time, I was like, I am going to write a story about this. And you've handed me the perfect story. And that was maybe in like 2019. And then I had that story in the back of my mind, but I couldn't really figure out what would happen. And then I was driving to Goodwill, actually, which we were just talking about. And I suddenly thought, what if she loses her father? And I like completely missed the turn for Goodwill and like came to my senses, you know, 16 miles out of town. And was like, oh, wait, I have to turn around. But that seemed so natural to me. And that seemed like that's what people with elderly parents fear. Like that seemed so natural, but I hadn't thought of it for some reason. I just thought about how maddening the hearing aid thing was.
Right.
And my dad was very conservative, and we had a lot of very heated discussions about this. And it's really funny because when my brothers would go visit him, they would text me complaining about something crazy that he'd said. And I would just be like, don't engage politically. Just, you know, tell dad, I love you, but I'm not going to discuss politics. And then I would visit my dad and would text my brothers and be like, oh my God, I want to fucking kill dad. He's driving me crazy. So I definitely wanted the dad in the story to be very, very conservative.
I don't know if you've read Jess Walter's Town and Country, but it reminded me so much of that story. I mean, these two guys absolutely could have been friends in the nursing home. They would have definitely gotten along. One thing I really wanted to point out to listeners who might be reading this for ideas on how to approach their own fiction is your use of lists. And I think almost all of the stories make such grand use of lists to either describe characters or describe the state of mind of a character, to describe the moods or what they're buying at the grocery store, whatever it is, to deepen character use of lists is awesome. I don't know if there's anything you can say about that technique and what it gives to you. It seems like kind of a nice way for me sometimes to break up writer's block. If I don't know where things are going, I'm like, I'll just make a list of anything about them. Tell me about your use of lists.
That's funny because it wasn't until my last book where somebody talked about the use of lists, and I was like, oh wow, I do use lists. Like it was not something I did consciously. In Damascus, I think she makes a couple of lists, one of stuff that she wouldn't have done if she hadn't
Yes.
been stoned. Usually when I do a list, I guess I am conscious of it in some way, but usually what I'm doing is to make a long list to get to a particular point, like a stinger at the very end of it. Like if I'm saying a character doesn't know anything, I'll say they don't know the difference between the heat and the electric bill, the night and day, all these things. And then the very last thing will be like love and sex, which is a very universal thing that almost nobody really understands. So in this story, I did want to talk about the character Mia, who had smoked a lot of weed as a teenager, and how it had led her to make a lot of bad decisions. And some of those decisions were just kind of comical, but some could have had really long-lasting, serious consequences. And I think the very last thing that she does in the list, which is to, do I say it? To give a blowjob to the driving teacher?
You're fine.
Okay.
You're fine.
So she gives a blowjob to the driving teacher. And I just think that I wanted that to show how truly far she fell as a teenager, how truly sort of lost she became.
And the great thing about that is that it's a little bit of foreshadowing for what happens in the story, right? So she made all these bad decisions as a teenager. She might be making some questionably bad decisions today. And there's this role reversal between she and her son, kind of throughout the story, but really punctuated at the end, where we now understand she's kind of acting as the kid and he's kind of acting as the grown up. And that whole list really set that up for us to understand not only who she was, where she came from, why she's parenting the way she is now, but also her relationship with her son and what she's worried about and what he should be worried about. Like it lifts a lot of weight. And it's funny. Everything she does is hilarious. So it's just this amazing way that A, it kind of, I think, unsticks writing sometimes and takes the pressure off to just be making lists of characters. But in that list, it's so revealing about who these people are and what's motivating them and where they're still stuck in their present lives based on their past behavior. And I don't know, it's really smart. Every time you made use of lists in the book, I thought, man, these lists are kind of doing double, triple duty sometimes because they're always funny and they're always revealing something else. And in that situation, like I say, it's also kind of foreshadowing what's to come.
I always like fiction that's very, very specific. Like if I read a book and they have pasta for dinner, I'm like, well, hold on. There's a lot of kinds of pasta, and I would like to know which one you're eating. So I always like things to be very specific. And there's another list in this same story where Mia thinks about how she would justify her relationship with her ex-husband to someone. And she thinks that she wants to explain that they share a lot of things. And I remember writing this and thinking, well, what do they share? And making a list. Like within the document, I just stopped and I did make a list. And then I sort of turn, switch them in and out and then turn them back into a paragraph because it ends with the thing that they have in common is love for their child. But then she also thinks that they share this membership to the Bethesda Swim Club, and she's not giving that up at this point.
Yes.
So yeah, I guess, maybe it's a way of sketching a character is to say, to make a really short, not short, but a condensed list of things in their past. The thing I want to say about that story is that when I was in high school, I used to go drinking at parties, and I would come home, and my parents' room was at the head of the stairs. So I would stop by their room, and they'd be in bed reading, and I would just do like stand up at the foot of their bed for half an hour. And my parents never thought this was anything but like spontaneous socialization. And then my older son began working at a supermarket, the evening shift or afternoon shift, getting home late at night. And sometimes he would come talk to us. And one night I was like, yeah, oh, you know, he just loves his job. His eyes are bright, his cheeks are flushed. Like he's high on life. And then I was like, oh my God, I have become my mother. So that's how that story came into being. So I guess that wasn't a thing of something funny happening, and I built a whole story around it. But I do remember sort of being halfway through, and I knew that I wanted her to have a very frustrating conversation with her ex-husband, where he's like saying the son shouldn't do weed, that if, because he lies around doing nothing already, he should do, you know, coke if he wants to get stuff done. I had that idea very early on in the story. And then I sort of stalled out. And one day I was like, because I didn't want it to turn out that the son was doing drugs. I didn't want that to be the point of the story. But I thought somebody should probably do drugs. Wait, what if it's the mother? So that did occur to me sort of halfway through. I think that is one of my favorite stories in the collection. I really like the mother and her son.
Yeah, I mean, every parent can relate to the moment when they make that switch from, oh my God, I really am the parent now. And then, but if you go down that line as a writer to make it predictable that we all expect that to happen, we expect the son to be using drugs and we expect the mother to be waiting at home for him. You always have to turn that on its head, or else it, turns out the way we all expect it to, and you don't want that in fiction.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love that twist and turn. And how did the title of that one, because you were talking about how you have difficulty with titles. Tell me about titling that one.
Well, I wanted it to be like about her sort of thinking, at least, that like her eyes have been opened and her kid is not as sweet as she always thought he was. And there were already like a million short stories and books and films called The Road to Damascus. And then I realized that there was a Damascus, Maryland. And I thought, okay, we'll just have Damascus and the rest will be sort of inferred. I'm trying to think if it had another title. I think that was always the title.
Is it easier for you to write about a place when you're kind of there in it? Or, I mean, you have stories set in Manhattan, you've got stories set there. I think you have some Midwest-y sort of feeling stories. Is it easier for you to be away from it?
Well, I almost always, if I'm writing a short story and it's not a novel and it doesn't have to be set in a certain season, I always write about like whatever the weather is outside, that's the weather in the story. I'm somehow not very good at like imagining weather. I also have a hard time dressing for weather. Yesterday, my bedroom was really hot, so I wore a t-shirt outside and it was really cold. I don't know. I have some mind weather disconnect. But you know, usually this the story takes place in wherever I am when I get the idea for the story. I
Okay.
get the story in the collection, Turn Back, which takes place in Manhattan. I got the idea for that story like 36 years ago. I was living in Manhattan and I had an idea that this couple would be confronting each other about infidelity late at night in their Manhattan kitchen, which I visualized as looking as like my kitchen did, and that it would somehow the frame would be reference the fairy tale called Turn Back, where in the fairy tale sometimes called it's often called the robber bridegroom, and the bride confronts the murderer bridegroom on their wedding day and says it was only a dream, it was only a dream, my love, but she shows that it wasn't a dream. So I had this idea that the robber bridegroom lines from it would be interwoven into their conversation. And then 36 years later, I wrote the story. It stuck with me for a long time, but I didn't know much about the story beyond that one scene.
Yeah, that was another example of another technique that I think writers can use is weaving in other texts from things. Fairy tales are just so evocative and work so well in short stories. I see a lot of fairy tale play in short stories, and I love being able to play with that and doing sort of modern tales and takes on it. I guess we should spend our last couple of minutes talking a little bit about publishing. And so, do you still send, even though now you've got collections and novels under your belt, when you finish a short story, are you still sending them out to be published on their own before they then land in the collection? Or do you just now write stories to be part of a collection?
No, I still send them out. I think that's an important part of being a short story writer is trying to get the stories published in magazines or periodicals, because that's really like where short stories came from. That's where the whole form came from. So it seems to me somehow an important like closing of the loop that you write a short story and you send it out. Maybe that's just a leftover of being a freelance writer for so long. But also, like I taught creative writing for a while, and the students never sent out their stories. And I was like, how do you guys think this works? Elves are not going to come in the night and publish these stories. You have to get them out there. And I have like 9 million securities insecurities, but rejection has never really been one of them. Like if a magazine rejects a story, then okay, I send it somewhere else.
As evidenced by being rejected 31 times and then the New Yorker calls the next day. I love that story. I love that, that rejection is not, it's not a reflection on the quality of the work. I mean, sometimes I suppose it could be, but I mean, that's not all it is. I mean, yeah, you've got to develop a thick skin and you can't take it personally. I mean, it really has, it's about so many things, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's so subjective. Nobody loves every, there's not a book that everyone loves.
Yeah. Or, a million other things could be going on with the journal that have nothing to do with your short story or the quality of it, at least.
I agree.
And have you noticed sort of a change? Because you've been at it for a long time. Have you noticed, do you approach it any differently? Or have you noticed there are more, I feel like there are fewer print journals, but more online journals. How has publishing short stories changed over the time you've been doing it?
Maybe it hasn't. I think that any journal or magazine has ever published a story of mine, I'm so grateful and I feel so lucky, because the number of stories they read and try to have to choose between is just, I think that's a really hard job.
And how is it with your publisher in terms of publishing novels versus short stories? They seem open to both.
Yeah, they did. I mean, for a long time when I was at Columbia, the prevailing wisdom was that the first book you publish has to be a novel. Everybody was like, don't publish short stories first. And that was really intimidating to me for a long time, because I wrote short stories and I struggled to write a novel, and I couldn't. And finally I was like, okay, I'm not a novelist, I'm a short story writer. And I just wrote. Then once I decided that, I wrote like more short stories than I knew what to do with. And some of them turned into novels. So I don't know, I guess the moral would be don't limit yourself. But I did lead with a collection of stories, and I'm glad I did. I think short stories are maybe more popular than they used to be.
I feel that too. I feel like they're having a bit of a renaissance and they're winning awards. I see them up for prizes more than I felt like they were. It is funny how things fall in and out of favor, but I'm such a short story fan, so I'm so excited when I see them doing well. Oh, is there any advice that we covered a lot of advice. Is there other stuff we should have said that we didn't say?
I do think there's always a reason not to write. It's very easy to find a reason not to write. And I think there's a lot to be said for just sitting at your desk and setting a timer and saying, I'm going to work for 30 minutes and we'll see where we are. I think maybe that's one of the hardest parts.
This is like a full circle moment because we're getting back to the deadlines that we started the
Oh,
conversation
yeah.
with, right? Yeah, if you just give yourself mini deadlines of 30 minutes or something. Yeah. I feel the timer is so useful because you can see the end. You can see it counting down. You can see yourself being released. And then it kind of frees you up to be like, well, if I'm going to be sitting here anyway, Might as well say something.
Well, and for a long time, I wrote pages per day or words per day. And I still do that somewhat. But if I'm stuck, I'm like, well, I'll just do 30 minutes. And minutes is a lot easier than pages. Pages are easy if you're feeling inspired. And no matter how many times this happens or how old I get, I never learn. Like, I'll have a day where I'm really on and I'll write like 5 pages, which is a lot for me. And I'll think, oh my God, the book's going to be done in 100 days. Like, I figured this out. And then the next day I'll write like a paragraph. I've never figured out how not to be like when I have a good day, I don't just be like, it's a good day. I'm always somehow thinking it's the rest of my life.
Yeah, you have to, or, you know, you'd be demoralized. Because if you did that on the days that you just wrote a paragraph, you'd quit. So you have to.
Oh, well, that's true.
You have to believe. You have to believe, especially as a writer. It's so much toiling alone. You gotta give yourself some cheerleading, I think. That's a good thing.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah.
I love
There's
this.
also, no matter what I'm writing, a novel or a short story, there's a point 2/3 of the way through where I'm convinced it's a mess and it's never going to work. And I always say to my husband, like, it's all this time wasted. It's a mess. It's unsavable. And he'll be like, are you 2/3 of the way through? Because you always say that. And I'll be like, oh, yeah. And for a long time when I was a young writer, I believed that I would write a good story and a bad story, and then a good story and a bad story. I just was very somehow superstitiously believed that. That took me a long time to get rid of.
And there's, you know, stories can be the right story at the wrong time and the wrong story at the right time or something also. So, yeah, there are things I think are terrible. And then I go back, I don't know, a year later and I'm like, not so bad. Well, this is wonderful. These were so funny. They were so relatable. That's the reason we come to fiction, I think, so many of the time, is to feel like, you know, we're not as crazy as we thought we were, because look at all these crazy people out there having the same thoughts we have. So this did that for me. I mean, there were so many relatable moments. I love that. I love all those points of connection. So thank you. Thank you for writing this.
Well, thank you. I think that actually, you know, like the highest hope I would have for my work is that, like, there are certain books that I like. There's a character in Anne Tyler's novel, The Accidental Tourist, who says that red wine makes her tongue feel rough. And every time I open a bottle of red wine, I like flash on that line. I think of that. So my hope would be that some line of mine like takes up residence in somebody's head and gives them a little pleasure every time they do something.
I'll never sit in an airport bar again without thinking of these women. And I sit in plenty of airport bars.
When I wrote that story, I was at my hometown airport waiting, and my flight was being delayed and delayed. And I was in the airport bar, and I overheard, like, a man came in and greeted somebody, and they were like, are you flying out? And he said, no, I just came out for a drink. And I was like, who come to the airport for a drink? And how did you get past security? And I texted my brother, who immediately texted back and was like, he's probably barred in all the bars in Midland. And I was like, what would make him banned there? And my brother replied right away with this like very long specific list, which I found really funny. And one of the things was doing donuts in the bar's parking lot. So my flight was actually on time, and I left before I found out how the man got past security and what he was doing there. But I think I wrote that story to answer the question of that for myself, because I did think about it a lot. I still do. Like, how do you get past security without a ticket?
So it's so funny. I live in Orange County, California, and our little airport here just passed this thing where you can now go behind security. You just have to bring your driver's license and whatever, and they'll let you back there. And I was like, why who's doing that? And they're like, well, you know, if you want to go shopping or have dinner out. And I'm like, what? Who has dinner out at the airport? And they're like, well, some people just like to, you know, watch the planes come and go or look at the art. And I'm like, that is so bizarre. But apparently,
the art.
Look at, well, our airport has a lot of art. So I just thought that was hilarious. So as I was reading this, I was like, well, you can do that in our airport. Maybe I should go there one night for, just to have some drinks.
Make some friends.
Make some friends. Yes.
A writer that I know posted on Facebook, I don't know, last year that she left her phone in an Uber on the way to the airport, and she went into the bar and like got people to lend her their phones and make contact with the Uber driver to get her phone back to her. And then she was so busy drinking with her new friends that she missed her flight.
Oh
I
my
was like,
God.
that is the best story in the whole world.
Always a reason to drink at the airport is what I have always said. Yes. Catherine Heine, this was so fun. Thank you so much for this.
It was really fun.
That was Catherine Heine. The book is Games and Rituals. It is out and available now in paperback. In addition to our Patreon page, you can always visit our websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com, two R's in Marie. And of course, the show's website is writersonwriting.com. You can always subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Stitcher. As always, our fantastic music and sound design was provided by Travis Barrett. You can find him on Spotify under Just My Type for more typewriter music, or visit travisbarrett.mykajabi.com. That's all the time we have for today. Tune in next week. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.